Chapter 19, Shadow the Sheepdog. Shadow the Sheepdog, the story of a supremely loyal and intelligent sheepdog in a rural pre-war countryside, was published by Collins in 1950. A compulsive scribbler from her early teens, Enid Blyton found escape from her own unhappy childhood in the simple tales she wove for children. She has been republished in revised forms to suit modern tastes and has consistently remained popular over 5 decades. The independently minded children of her stories live in an idealized world of eternal summer holidays, adventure, high tea, ginger beer, cake, and grown-ups with so little intelligence that they need everything explained to them. Something that is not so very far from the truth. Mion de Floss, Enid Blyton. I read myself into Shadow's featured town halfway down page 231. Johnny, the farmer's boy who was Shadow's owner and co-protagonist, would be having Shadow's eyes checked in a few days, so a brief reconnaissance of the locality seemed like a good idea. If I could persuade rather than order the vet to swap the dogs, then so much the better. I alighted in a town that looked like some sort of 40s English rural idyll. A mix between Warwickshire and the Dales. All green grass, show quality cattle, yellow lichen stone walls, sunshine and healthy-looking, smiling people. Horses pulled carts laden high with hay down the main street, and the odd shiny motor car puttered past. Pies cooled on window sills, and children played with hoops and tinplate steam engines. The smell in the breeze was of freshly mown grass, clean linen and cooking. Here was a world of high tea, tasty trifles, zero crime, eternal summers and boundless good health. I suspected living here might be quite enjoyable. For about a week. I was nodded at by a passerby. "Beautiful day," she said politely. "Yes, my... rain later?" I looked up at the puffy clouds that stretched away to the horizon. "I shouldn't have thought so, but can you..." "Well, be seeing you," said the woman politely, and was gone. I found an alleyway and tied the sheepdog to a downpipe. It was neither useful nor necessary to lead a dog around town for the next few hours. I walked carefully down the road past a family butcher's, a tea room, and sweet shop selling nothing but gobstoppers, bull's eyes, ginger beer, lemonade, and licorice. A few doors farther on, I found a newsagent and post office combined. The outside of the small shop was liberally covered with enamel signs advertising Fry's chocolates, Coleman's starch, Wincarnis tonic, Ovaltine and Lion's cakes. A small sign told me I could use the telephone, and a rack of postcards shared the pavement with boxes of fresh veg. There was also a display of newspapers, the headlines reflecting the interwar politics of the book. "Britain voted favourite empire 10th year running," said one. "Foreigners untrustworthy, study shows," said another. A third led with "spiffing, new buzzword sweeps nation." I posted the smoother check to Johnny's father with a covering letter explaining that it was an old loan repaid. Almost immediately, a postman appeared on a bicycle and removed the letter, the only one in the postbox, I noted, with the utmost of reverence, taking it into the post office where I could hear cries of wonderment. There weren't many letters in Shadow, I assumed. I stood outside the shop for a moment, watching the townsfolk going about their business. Without warning, one of the cart horses decided to put a huge pile of dung in the middle of the road. In a trice, a villager had run across with a bucket and shovel and removed the offending article almost as soon as it had happened. I watched for a while, and then set off to find the local auctioneers.
"So let me get this straight," said the auctioneer, a heavy-set and humourless man with a monocle screwed into his eye. "You want to buy pigs at treble the going rate? Why?"
"Not anyone's pigs," I replied wearily, having spent the last half hour trying to explain what I wanted. "Johnny's father's pigs."
"Quite out of the question," muttered the auctioneer,
getting to his feet and walking to the window. He did it a lot, I could tell. There was a worn patch right through the carpet to the floorboards beneath, but only from his chair to the window. There was another worn patch from the door to a side table, the use of which I was yet to understand.
Considering his limitations, I guessed the auctioneer was no more than a C9 generic. It explained the difficulty of persuading him to alter anything.
"We do things to a set formula here," added the auctioneer, "and we don't very much like change."
He walked back across the worn floorboards to his desk, turned to face me and wagged a reproachful finger.
"And believe me, if you try anything a bit rum at the auction, I can discount your bid."
We stared at each other. This wasn't working.
"Tea and cake?"
asked the auctioneer, walking to the window again. "Thank you."
"Splendid."
He rubbed his hands together and returned to his desk.
"They tell me there is nothing quite so refreshing as a cup of tea."
He flipped the switch on the intercom.
"Miss Pittman, would you bring in some tea, please?"
The door opened instantaneously to reveal his secretary holding a tray of tea things. She was in her late 20s and pretty in an English rose sort of way. She wore a floral summer dress under a fawn cardigan. Miss Pittman followed the smoothly worn-down floorboards and carpet from the door to the side of the table. She curtsied and laid the tea things next to an identical tray left from an earlier occasion. She threw the old tea tray out the window, and I heard the soft tinkle of broken crockery. I had seen a large pile of broken tea things outside the window when I arrived. His secretary paused, hands pressed tightly together.
Shall I pour you a cup?"
she asked, a flush rising to her cheeks.
"Thank you,"
exclaimed Mr. Phillips, walking excitedly to the window and back again.
"Milk and..."
"One sugar," his secretary smiled shyly. Yes, I know."
"But of course you do,"
he smiled back. Then the next stage of this odd charade took place. The auctioneer and secretary moved to the place where their two worn paths were closest, the outer limits that their existence and limited storyline allowed them. Miss Pittman held the cup by its rim, placed her toes right on the edge where the worn carpet began and shiny floorboard ended, stretching out as far as she could. Mr. Phillips did the same on his side of the divide. The tips of his fingers could just touch the opposite rim of the cup, but try as he might, he could not reach far enough to grasp it.
"Allow me," I said. Unable to watch the cruel spectacle any longer, I passed the cup from one to the other.
How many cups of tea had gone cold in the past 35 years, I wondered. How uncrossable the 6 feet of carpet that divided them. Whoever event managed this book down in the well had a cruel sense of humour. Miss Pittman curtsied politely and departed while the auctioneer watched her go. He sat down at his desk, eyeing the teacup thirstily. He licked his lips and rubbed his fingertips in expectation, then took a sip and savoured the moment lovingly.
"Oh, my goodness," he said deliriously. "Even better than I thought it would be."
He took another sip and closed his eyes with the sheer delight of it.
"Where were we?"
he asked. I took a deep breath. "I want you to buy Johnny's father's pigs with an offer that purports to come from an unknown buyer, and as close to the top of page 232 as you can."
"Utterly impossible. You are asking me to change the narrative. I will have to see higher authority."
I passed him my jurisfiction ID card. It wasn't like me to pull rank, but I was getting desperate. "I'm on official business sanctioned by the Council of Genres themselves through Text Grand Central." It was how I thought Miss Havisham might say it.
"You forget that we are out of print pending modernization," he replied shortly, tossing my ID back across the table. "You have no mandatory powers here, Apprentice Next. I think jurisfiction will look very carefully before attempting a change on a book without internal approval. You can tell the bellman that from me."
We stared at each other, a diplomatic impasse having arrived. I had an idea. "How long have you been auctioneer in this book?"
36 years.
"And how many cups of tea have you had in that time?"
"Including this one?"
I nodded.
"One."
I leaned forward. "I can fix it for you to have as many cups of tea as you want, Mr. Phillips." He narrowed his eyes. "Oh, yes?"
And how would you manage that? As soon as you've got what you want, you'll be off, and I'll never be able to reach Miss Pittman's proffered cup again.
I stood up and went to the table on which the tea tray was lying. It was a small table made of oak and lightly decorated. It had a vase of flowers on it, but nothing else. As Mr. Phillips watched, I picked up the table and placed it next to the window. The auctioneer looked at me dumbfounded, got up, walked to the window, and delicately touched the table and the tea things.
"An audacious move," he said, waving the sugar tongs at me. "But it won't work. She's a D7. She won't be able to change what she does."
"D7s never have names, Mr. Phillips."
"I gave her that name," he said quietly. "You're wasting your time."
"Let's see, shall we?" I spoke into the intercom to ask Miss Pittman to bring in more tea. The door opened as before, and a look of shock and surprise crossed the girl's face.
"The table!" she gasped,
rattling the Royal Doulton tea things on the tray.
"It's..."
"You can do it, Miss Pittman," I told her. "Just place the tea where you always do." She moved forward, following the well-worn path, arrived at where the table used to be, and then looked at its new position 2 strides away. The smooth and unworn carpet was alien and fearful to her. It might as well have been a bottomless chasm. She stopped dead.
"I don't understand," she began,
her face bewildered as her hands continued to shake. "Tell her to put the tea things down," I told the auctioneer, who was becoming as distressed as Miss Pittman. Perhaps more so.
"Tell her."
"Thank you, Miss Pittman," murmured Mr. Phillips, his voice croaking with emotion. "Put the tea things down over here, would you?"
She bit her lip and closed her eyes, raised her foot and held it, quivering above the edge of the shiny floorboards. Then she moved it forward and rested it on the soft carpet. She opened her eyes, looked down, and beamed at us both.
"Well done,"
I said.
"Just 2 more.
Brimming with confidence, she negotiated the 2 remaining steps with ease and placed the tray on the table. She and Mr. Phillips were closer now than they had ever been before. She put out a hand to touch his lapel, but checked herself quickly.
Shall I pour you a cup?"
"Thank you,"
exclaimed Mr. Phillips.
"Milk and..."
"One sugar,"
she smiled shyly.
"Yes, yes, I know."
She poured the tea and handed the cup and saucer to him. He took it gratefully.
"Mr. Phillips?"
"Yes?"
"Do I have a first name?"
"Of course,"
he replied quietly and with great emotion.
"I have had over 30 years to think about it. Your name is Aurora, as befits somebody as beautiful as the dawn."
She covered her nose and mouth to hide her smile and blushed deeply. Mr. Phillips raised a shaking hand to touch her cheek, but stopped as he remembered that I was still present. He nodded imperceptibly in my direction and said,
"Thank you, Miss Pittman. Perhaps later you might come in for some... dictation."
"I will look forward to it, Mr. Phillips."
And she turned, trod softly on the carpet to the door, looked round once more and went out. When I looked back at Mr. Phillips, he had sat down, drained by the emotionally charged encounter. "Do we have a deal? Or do I put the table back where it was?" He looked shocked.
"You wouldn't."
"I would." He considered his position for a moment and then offered me his hand. "Pigs at treble the going rate? Top of page 232.
Deal."
Pleased with my actions so far, I collected the dog and jumped forward to the middle of page 232. By now the sale of Johnny's father's pigs was the talk of the town and had even made it into the headlines of the local papers. "Unprecedented pig prices shock town." There was only one thing left to do. Replace the blind collie for the sighted one.
"I'm looking for the vet,"
I asked a passerby.
"Are you?"
replied the woman amiably.
"Good for you!"
And she hurried on.
"Could you tell me the way to the vet?"
I asked the next person, a sallow man in a tweed suit. He was no less literal.
"Yes, I could."
He attempted to walk on. I tried to grasp him by the sleeve, but missed and momentarily clasped his hand. He gasped out loud. This was echoed by two women who had witnessed the incident. They started to gossip volubly. I pulled out my ID.
Jurisfiction, I told him, adding, on official business, just to make sure he got the picture.
But something had happened. The townsfolk, who up until that moment had seemed to wander the streets like automatons, were all of a sudden animated individuals, talking, whispering and pointing. I was a stranger in a strange land, and while the townsfolk didn't seem hostile, I was clearly an object of considerable interest.
I need to get to the vet, I said loudly. Now, can anyone tell me where he lives?
The two ladies who had been chattering suddenly smiled and nodded to one another.
We'll show you where he works.
I left the first man still staring at his hand and looking at me in an odd way. I didn't take offence. People looked at me oddly quite a lot. I followed the ladies to a small building set back from the road. I thanked them both, one of whom I noticed remained at the gate while the other bustled away with a purposeful stride. I rang the doorbell.
Hello?
Said the vet, opening the door and looking surprised. He only had one client booked that day, Johnny and Shadow. The vet was meant to tell the young lad how Shadow would stay blind forever.
This dog, said the vet automatically, we'll never see again. I'm sorry, but that's the way it is.
Jurisfiction, I told him, showing him my ID. There's been a change of plan.
What sort of change?
He asked as I gently forced my way in and closed the door.
Are you here to alter the less than savoury references to stereotypical gypsy folk in chapters 13 to 15?
We'll get around to that, don't you worry. I wasn't going to take any chances and go through the same rigmarole as I had with Mr. Phillips, so I looked round furtively and said in a conspiratorial whisper,
I shouldn't be telling you this, but wicked men are planning to steal Shadow and sell him off for medical experiments.
No!
Exclaimed the vet, eyes wide open.
Indeed, I replied, adding in a hushed tone, and what's more, we suspect that these men might not even be English.
You mean Johnny foreigners?
Asked the vet, visibly shocked.
Probably French. Now, are you with me on this?
Absolutely,
he breathed.
What are we going to do? Swap dogs. When Johnny arrives, you tell him to go outside for a moment. We swap the dogs. When he comes back, you unwrap the bandages, the dog can see, and you say this dialogue instead.
I handed him a scrap of paper. He looked at it thoughtfully.
So, Shadow stays here, and the swapped Shadow is abducted by Johnny Foreigner and used for medical experiments?
Something like that.
But not a word to anyone, you understand?
Word of honour, replied the vet.
So I gave him the collie, and sure enough, when Johnny brought in the blinded Shadow, the vet told him to go and get some water. We swapped dogs, and when Johnny returned, lo and behold, the dog could see again. The vet feigned complete surprise, and Johnny, of course, was delighted. They left soon after. I stepped from the office where I had been hiding.
How did I do?
Asked the vet, washing his hands. Perfect. There could be a medal in it for you. It all seemed to have gone swimmingly well. I couldn't believe my luck. But more than that, I had the feeling that Havisham might actually be quite proud of her apprentice. At the very least, this should make up for having to rescue me from the grammar sites. Pleased, I opened the door to the street and was surprised to find that a lot of the locals had gathered, and they all seemed to be staring at me. My feeling of euphoria over the completed mission suddenly evaporated as unease welled up inside me.
It's time! It's time!
Announced one of the ladies I had seen earlier.
Time for what?
Time for a wedding.
Whose?
I asked, not unreasonably.
Why, yours, of course! She answered happily. You touch Mr. Townsperson's hand. You are betrothed. It is the law.
The crowd surged towards me and I reached not for my gun, but for my travel book in order to get out quickly. It was the wrong choice. Within a few moments, I'd been overpowered. They took my book and gun, then held me tightly and propelled me towards a nearby house, where I was forced into a wedding dress that had seen a lot of previous use and was several sizes too big.
You won't get away with this!
I told them as they hurriedly brushed and plaited my hair with two men holding my head. Jurisfiction will know where I am and will come after me, I swear.
You'll get used to married life,
exclaimed one of the women, her mouth full of pins.
They all complain to begin with, but by the end of the afternoon they are as meek as lambs. Isn't that so, Mr. Rustic?
Aye, Mrs. Passerby, said one of the men, holding my arms. Like lambs, meek.
You mean there were others?
There is nothing like a good wedding, said one of the other men. Nothing except...
Here, Mr. Rustic nudged him, and he was quiet. Nothing except what? I asked, struggling again.
Oh, hush, said Mrs. Passerby. You made me drop a stitch. Do you really want to look a mess on your wedding day?
Yes! 10 minutes later, bruised and with my hands tied behind my back and a garland of flowers in my badly pinned hair, I was being escorted towards the small village church. I managed to grab the lych gate on the way in, but was soon pulled clear. A few moments later I was standing at the altar next to Mr. Townsperson, who was neatly dressed in a morning suit. He smiled at me happily and I scowled back.
We are gathered here today, in the eyes of God, to bring together this woman and this man.
I struggled, but it was no good.
This proceeding has no basis in law,
I shouted, attempting to drown out the vicar. He signalled to the verger, who placed a bit of sticking plaster over my mouth. I struggled again, but with four burly farm workers holding me, it was useless. I watched with a sort of strange fascination as the wedding proceeded, the villagers snivelling with happiness in the small church. When it came to the vow, four men's head was vigorously nodded for me, and a ring pressed on my finger.
I now pronounce you man and wife. You may kiss the bride.
Mr. Townsperson loomed closer. I tried to back away, but was held tightly. Mr. Townsperson kissed me tenderly on the sticking plaster that covered my mouth. As he did so, an excited murmur went up from the congregation. There was applause and I was dragged towards the main door, covered in confetti, and made to pose for a wedding photograph. For the picture, the sticking plaster was removed, so I had time to make my protestations.
No coerced wedding was ever recognised by law, I bellowed. Let me go right now and I may not report you.
Don't worry, Mrs. Townsperson, said Mrs. Passerby, addressing me. In 10 minutes it really won't matter. You see, we rarely get the opportunity to perform nuptials, as no one in here ever gets married. The well never went so far as to offer us that sort of luxury.
What about the others you mentioned? I asked, a sense of doom rising within me.
Where are the other brides who were forced into marriage?
Everyone looked solemn, clasped their hands together and stared at the ground.
What's going on? What will happen in 10 minutes?
I turned as the four men let go of me and saw the vicar again. But he wasn't cheery this time. He was solemn. And well he might be. Before him was a freshly dug grave. Mine.
Oh, my God!
I muttered.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered, began the vicar,
as the same townsfolk began to sniffle into their hankies again. But this time the tears weren't of happiness, they were of sorrow.
I cursed myself for being so careless.
Mr. Townsperson had my automatic and released the safety. I looked around desperately. Even if I had been able to get a message to Havisham, I doubted whether she could have made it in time.
Mr. Townsperson, I said in a quiet voice, staring into his eyes. My own husband. You would kill your bride?
He trembled slightly and glanced at Mrs. Passerby.
I'm afraid so, my dear, he faltered.
Why? I asked, stalling for time.
We need the...
For Panjandrum's sake, get on with it, or I shall,
snapped Mrs. Passerby, who seemed to be the chief instigator of all this.
I need my emotional fix.
Wait, I said.
You're after emotion?
They call us sentiment junkies, said Mr. Townsperson sadly. It's not our fault. We're all generics rated between C7 and D3. We don't have many emotions of our own, but are smart enough to know what we're missing.
If you don't kill her, I shall,
mumbled Mr. Rustic, tapping my husband on the elbow. He pulled away,
She has a right to know. She is my wife, after all.
He looked nervously left and right.
Go on.
We started with humorous one-liners that offered a small kick. That kept us going for a few months, but soon we wanted more. Laughter, joy, happiness in any way we could get it. Thrice-monthly garden fetes, weekly harvest festivals and tombola four times a day were not enough. We wanted the hard stuff.
Grief,
murmured Mrs. Passerby.
Grief, sadness, sorrow, loss. We wanted it, but we wanted it strong. Ever read on Her Majesty's Secret Service?
I nodded.
We wanted that. Our hearts raised by the happiness of a wedding and then dashed by the sudden death of the bride.
I stared at the slightly crazed generics, unable to generate emotions synthetically from within the confines of their happy rural idyll. They had embarked upon a systematic rampage of enforced weddings and funerals to give them the high they desired. I looked at the graves in the churchyard and wondered how many others had suffered this fate.
"We will all be devastated by your death, of course," whispered Mrs. Passerby. "But we will get over it. The slower, the better."
"Wait," I said. "I have an idea."
"We don't want any ideas, my love," said Mr. Townsperson, pointing the gun at me again. "We want emotion."
"How long will this fix last?" I asked him. "A day? How sad can you be for someone you barely know?" They all looked at one another. I was right. The fix they were getting by killing and burying me would last them until tea time, if they were lucky.
"You have a better idea?"
"I can give you more emotion than you know how to handle. Feeling so strong you won't know what to do with yourselves."
"She's lying," cried Mrs. Passerby dispassionately. "Kill her now. I can't wait any longer. I need the sadness. Give it to me."
"I'm jurisfiction. I can bring more jeopardy and strife into this book than 1,000 Blightons could give you in a lifetime."
"You could?"
echoed the townspeople excitedly, lapping up the expectation I was generating.
"Yes, and here's how I can prove it. Mrs. Passerby?"
"Yes."
"Mr. Townsperson told me earlier he thought you had a fat arse."
"He said what?"
she replied angrily, her face suffused with joy as she fed off the hurt feelings I had generated.
"I most certainly said no such thing,"
blustered Mr. Townsperson, obviously getting a bit hid himself from the indignation.
"Us too,"
yelled the townsfolk excitedly, eager to see what else I had in my bag of goodies. "Nothing before you untie me." They did so with great haste. Sorrow and happiness had kept them going for a long time, but they had grown bored. I was here like a dealer, offering new and different experiences. I asked for my gun and was handed it, the townspeople watching me expectantly like a dodo waiting for marshmallows.
"For a start," I said, rubbing my wrists and throwing the wedding ring aside, "I can't remember who got me pregnant."
There was a sudden silence.
"Shocking,"
said the vicar.
"Outrageous, morally repugnant,
But better than that," I added. "If you had killed me, you would also have killed my unborn son. Guilt like that could have lasted for months."
"Yes,"
yelled Mr. Rustic.
"Kill her now."
I pointed the gun at them and they stopped in their tracks. "You'll always regret not having killed me," I murmured. The townsfolk went quiet and mused upon this, the feeling of loss coursing through their veins.
"It feels wonderful,"
said one of the farm workers, taking a seat on the grass to focus his mind more carefully on the strange emotional potpourri of a missed opportunity of double murder. But I wasn't done yet. "I'm going to report you to the Council of Genres and tell them how you tried to kill me. You could be shut down and reduced to text." I had them now. They all had their eyes closed and were rocking backwards and forwards, moaning quietly. "Or perhaps," I added, beginning to back away, "I won't." I pulled off the wedding dress at the lich gate and looked back. The townspeople were laid out on the ground, eyes closed, surfing their inner feelings on a cocktail of mixed emotions. They wouldn't be down for days. I picked up my jacket and travel book on the way to the vet's, where the blind shadow was waiting for me. I had completed the mission, even if I had come a hair's breadth from a sticky end. I could do better, and would, given time. I heard a low, growly voice close at hand.
What happens to me? Am I reduced to text?
It was Shadow. Officially, yes.
I see. And unofficially?
I thought for a moment. Do you like rabbits?
Rather.
I pulled out my travel book. Good. Give me your paw. We're off to Rabbit Grand Central.